Many Americans look for ways to connect with their family roots. Some Native Americans find that link through their language.
If I talk about my Seneca language, and I talk about the trees, I talk about the water, and I talk about up there.
I'm Kara Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we revisit a school where members of the Seneca Nation of Indians keep their language and a connection to the earth alive. Plus, a British politician tours Pennsylvania to decide if fracking is a good idea for the UK. And who tries to sail a catamaran on Pittsburgh's choppy rivers? This guy.
The other boaters here don't really know what to do with me.
All that and more is coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. You've probably heard that fracking a natural gas well uses millions of gallons of water. Well, drillers in Pennsylvania now have a new source for that water: old coal mines. Governor Tom Wolf signed a new bill into law this week. It would limit the liabilities of using treated mine water in oil and gas operations. Supporters say the law will reduce the industry's use of fresh water and could improve water quality in rivers and streams, because companies will have more incentive to treat water polluted with acid mine drainage. How Pennsylvania grows its fracking industry is being viewed as something of a living laboratory in other parts of the world, a place to learn what works and what doesn't. More than 40 countries have shale gas, but many are undecided about whether to allow hydraulic fracturing. The United Kingdom is in the midst of such a debate. One English politician wanted to know more about fracking, so he decided to visit Pennsylvania to do a little research of his own. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier tagged along.
Inside a hotel just outside of Pittsburgh, Kevin Hollenrake is mingling.
Lovely to meet you, too.
Thank you very much.
Hollenrake is a member of the British Parliament. He's a conservative. He and his wife, Nikki, are in Butler County at the end of a four-day trek through Pennsylvania. They're about to tour the area with a parent group that's upset about fracking. But first, there's the little matter of giving out gifts from back home.
There's another one in the car. Now, these are fudge.
Oh!
There's a moratorium on fracking in the UK right now. But one company has applied to frack for natural gas in Hollenrake's home district in northern England. He and Nikki have organized this tour of Pennsylvania to see fracking up close.
I mean, it was completely my idea that we came out here, and as a parent of, you know, we've obviously both parents of four children, so it's quite important that we get a safety angle on this.
Kevin Hollenrake is visiting with the Mars Parent Group. The group is trying to get frack sites pushed farther away from schools. The first stop on their tour is down the street from the local high school at a new gas processing plant. It's already being expanded.
The propane, the butane, all the other stuff that goes into tanks. And you can smell.
Pickup trucks come and go from the plant on a small country road. Hollenrake stands on the driveway of a suburban-style house that's now right across the street from what's essentially a small refinery.
Well, as I said before, we came here. I want to know which questions to ask.
Right.
And this is a huge question.
Yeah. Where would you put this?
I've no idea.
Yeah. Where would you
Not near my house.
Yeah.
Hollenrake says his district in England is similar to Pennsylvania, a mix of agriculture, tourism, and industry. He wanted to tour the state because he sees it as a kind of laboratory for fracking.
I think we wanted to be able to say to the people in the UK, in our constituency, is we tried to see the worst of it as well as hear the best of it. So, and I think what I've seen in Pennsylvania, you've seen certainly the worst of it.
That may be hard to hear, but Pennsylvania has felt environmental impacts from the shale gas boom. Before today, Hollenrake visited Dimmock, where a state investigation found more than a dozen water wells were contaminated from gas drilling. He also met with the Marcellus Shale Coalition, an industry group, and with the State Department of Environmental Protection. He says state regulators admit mistakes were made.
Well, I think we got a degree of honesty. I think they certainly accepted that things had gone wrong, that they were wet behind the ears when this all first started, and they've learnt an awful lot, and they didn't have the number of people on the ground. It sounds almost like the Wild West here when fracking started in 2008.
Hollenrake says what shocked him the most is that in Pennsylvania, people generally don't get much say in deciding whether companies can drill near their homes. He says it's not like that in England, where local planning boards are required to consider how new industries will impact people and neighborhoods.
And to look at factors about noise about light pollution, about traffic on people's lives. That doesn't seem to be forming part of the analysis about a permit, which I find incredible.
On Hollenrake's final tour stop, the parent group takes him to a dairy farm where crews are installing a pipeline. They want him to understand that once fracking starts, pipelines are the next step in creating a natural gas economy. They worry about the risks, but he says those risks aren't unique to fracking.
You have to think about the radius that could be potentially impacted by a pipeline rupture or explosion.
You could say that about conventional gas, couldn't you? And we do rely on gas. We do need. There's always going to be a compromise somewhere along the line.
He's sympathetic to these parents, but he also sees a benefit for his country in shale gas.
In the past, we have undertaken large engineering projects and things that have taken our economies forward over the last hundreds of years. And if we just waited every time until we established there'd be no risk, we probably wouldn't have done anything.
At the end of the tour, Hollenrake gets back into his rental car. He has a flight to catch back to England, and he's got a lot to think about. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
A photograph caught our eye. Jessica Clark snapped one from the air while traveling across the country. It's of her home state of Pennsylvania, still green and lush far below. She uploaded it to icchange.org. That's where we saw it. ICChange is a crowdsourced climate reporting site. It's like a journal of what's happening in our natural environment. So people like you and Jessica Clark can help tell our region's climate stories. From her airplane seat, she was also reading a sci-fi book that fast-forwards to a future where no one gets to fly, to keep carbon footprints low and force future Earthlings to deal with weather volatility. And so she wondered, how will Pennsylvania adjust to the predicted climate shifts? Well, here's what one expert had to say. Ray Najar is an oceanographer at Penn State University. He says Pennsylvania will probably still be pretty lush 60 years from now. There'll be more rain, more water to deal with, even in the winter.
Pretty much the state is almost completely devoid of snow.
And we'll be looking at how to manage hotter summers.
To imagine Pennsylvania with, you know, summers like northern Alabama summers, you know, some people might like that, you know, but I feel like it's upsetting the balance.
You don't have to wait 60 years to notice and report changes that are happening around you. Go to icchange.org. You can even do it on your smartphone and ask a question like Jessica did. Upload a photo. Show us what you see. Then we'll find scientists to help complete the picture. That's ICChange, ICChange.org. Columbus Day, the holiday traditionally honoring the Italian explorer Christopher Columbus, is getting a makeover in some cities. Pittsburgh is joining the ranks of Seattle, Minneapolis, and others that now recognize Indigenous Peoples Day on the second Monday in October. Pittsburgher Miguel Segay is originally from Cuba, from the Taino Indian culture. And he was one of the supporters of the push to get the city to recognize the other side of Columbus's legacy.
So to make a hero of this man is a grave mistake. It's a man whose idea was that if he found gentle, generous people, they should be enslaved.
Segay made those comments at the Council of the Three Rivers American Indian Center's annual powwow, held just north of Pittsburgh. He was speaking about his people, the Taino, who were the first that Columbus met in the Americas. Amid the powwows, dancing and singing and traditional foods, Segay and I walked to a quiet nature path behind the center's buildings. Sitting on some benches in front of a stand of sacred trees, we talked a little about Columbus and environmental issues in Pennsylvania from a Native American perspective.
Columbus and of course, the wave of Europeans that followed brought so many changes to the environment, many diseases that Native people were exposed to, even the reintroduction of the earthworm, which changed the landscape of the Americas. So I'm wondering, as a Native person, how Native people today think of the environmental degradation that's associated with Columbus, if you could talk a little bit about that.
I think that there is a lot that has happened in this country that did not need to happen in terms of changing certain elements of nature. I would rather it not have happened. Is it bad or good? The words bad and good are kind of crazy words, because they're, you know, the world isn't even what it used to be, 20,000 years ago. It looked totally different. So change in itself is not bad or good. If it's something that we perceive as negative, then definitely that has been a degradation. I always have this issue with the whole thing of Johnny Appleseed. You know, the legend of Johnny Appleseed is an interesting legend that has always been close to the heart of Americans, because Johnny Appleseed, the guy that supposedly introduced apples all over the country. Well, apples may be nice, and I love apple pie and everything like that, but the concept of somebody coming and purposely introducing an invasive, a non-native species to take the place of other species, that is, you know, abominable. The whole idea is abominable, you know, to me.
So many things have been lost in the past, but now we have a choice for what could be lost to the future.
Yeah, exactly. And right now, things are going a little downhill with this fracking thing, and we're right in the middle of that. This is a good time to look at the spirit of Native American conservation practices and say, do we really need this for the economic welfare of Pennsylvania? It is really to our advantage to review indigenous values and say, you know, do we really want to throw our weight behind fracking?
Can you talk about what some of those values are?
For one thing, in the spiritual tradition of many tribes, everything had life in it, not just the things that obviously are alive, but things like stones. So when you take that life for your own personal use, there's always been this sense of gratitude that includes not wantonly destroying, but being very selective in what you're going to take. And that's what I mean.
You know, some of the concepts of the modern environmental movement come from Native American culture, like the concept of seventh generation, which I think comes from the Iroquois. That's where every decision that's made takes into consideration how it will impact the next seven generations. Now, of course, that's a company that makes, you know, supposedly green environmental cleaning products. So that name has been used for marketing purposes. But I guess I want to know if you think it's a good thing.
I consider myself a realist and a practical person. I'm 64 years old, and I remember the time when environmentalism was considered fringe lunacy. And nobody, no marketer, no politician, would even consider lining themselves up with environmentalists, because it was like, you know, it was political suicide. So for me to see companies that would otherwise be reveling in millions, destroying the environment, rushing madly towards the word green, I think that is a success. There are many cynics. You know, it's just like the racial equality movement in this country. There's a lot of people that would prefer to just say, well, you know, things are just as bad. No, no, no. Things are not just as bad as they were. No. I came to this country from Cuba in 1961. And things are not as bad as they were back then. There has been enormous progress. And there has been enormous progress in the environmental movement. When we planted those four trees back there in 1990, back then already people were amazed. I was amazed at how much progress we had made since the days of Rachel Carson. So I see it as a victory. We forced you guys to run to the word green. Kicking and screaming, we dragged them to that.
Native Americans, Native people.
Yes, absolutely. Because we've been part of the environmental movement. We Native Americans. We try to educate environmentalists from the indigenous point of view, because environmentalists, bless their souls, sometimes they miss the mark when it comes to the Indian perspective. Native people, true Native culture, I'll give you a perfect example of that, would never say they're raping the earth. The earth, this mother, is an immensely powerful entity. We're like little ants. We don't rape the earth. Can't. It's impossible. We do things that change the environment in ways that makes it inimical to human existence. And then things are really bad for us. Things go downhill for us humans and other living things that are like us. Is that raping the earth? You know, the earth has gone through many changes during its history and was still the earth. It's always been the earth. This is the face that it has now. So we see the earth as this incredibly powerful and almost scary entity. You never say, rape the earth. It's just ridiculous.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate your time and your honesty.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Miguel Segay, a medicine man at the Council of the Three Rivers American Indian Center. You can hear more of that conversation at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. And stay tuned. We'll hear about a Seneca school trying to preserve their tribe's roots. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Call him a maverick. Call him a little crazy. We'll just call him what he is, a sailor, maneuvering a catamaran through the wind and currents on the river.
You have to get all the pieces just right, and when you get all the pieces just right, you have an amazing experience. Get some of the pieces wrong, and it won't go well.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, we meet the Popeye of Pittsburgh's Three Rivers. He is what he is, and he's got skills. Stay tuned. Hundreds of Seneca Indians lost their homes in the 1960s when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers built a dam in northwestern Pennsylvania. The dam's reservoir flooded their land and traditions. A new generation has been trying to preserve their way of life at a school focused on the Seneca language. The Allegheny Front's Anne Murray visited the school more than a decade ago, and their work continues.
Okay. Back to bay.
It's a sunny day in Salamanca. Young Seneca students lurch and lunge in a game of keep away. Although they look like any group of kids at recess, they share a big responsibility.
My Indian name is Guyana Sate, and my English name is Brooke Krause Kennedy. I'm here because I'm trying to be one of the ones to preserve our culture and just learn.
Brooke and 12 other students are here at Faith Keeper School to learn the Seneca language and the teachings of the Longhouse religion. They range in age from 7 to 14. Their Cedarwood School rests on the Allegheny Reservation, a narrow strip of land that follows the upper reaches of the Allegheny River from Pennsylvania to New York. In 1998, tribal elders Dar and Sandy Dowdy rallied the community and started the school. They estimate that without immediate efforts, the Seneca language could disappear in 15 years. Dowdy says the existence of his people depends upon the survival of their oral tradition.
The language is the basis for everything. If I talk about my Seneca language, and I talk about the trees, I talk about the water, and I talk about up there. And that's what I need to teach these kids. And that's what my wife Sandy's doing.
We're going to talk about this story today.
This morning, longtime teacher Sandy Dowdy works with very young students. They're here for a special late summer session. As they gather around Dowdy in the school's lone classroom, she tells the traditional Seneca story of creation.
Remember from that tree, now in the sky world, grew all of the things that we need on earth. What kind of thing do you need that's growing on earth? What do you need?
Food.
What kind of food?
Right, potatoes.
Okay.
Maple syrup.
Maple syrup, good one.
Berries.
Awesome. I love berries.
Corn.
Corn, okay. Now do you see why your identity is so important?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We need everything that we need is on your identity.
Thanking Yuensadeh, the earth, and its creator for the bounty of nature is the building block for learning the Seneca language and ceremonies. Today, this handful of students learns a shorter version of the Thanksgiving speech. It's a traditional greeting that can take nearly an hour to recite. The speech stresses the interconnection between the natural world and the well-being of individual people.
It's skat and waye ungwatni goin deity no nyo johehko dani honiyo down ungwatni goin skat and waye ungwatni goin then one on yo die when ye dani honiyo down ungwatni goin. We covered just the ceremonial part and the giving thanks part, and then that's where for example, we do everything that's important to us in the morning. And then in the afternoon, we do activities that pertain to that, but are either science-related or activity-related. You know, we study things. We look into erosion and pollution and all of those things that we can do to protect those things that we just gave thanks for.
These lessons have a real-life application in the school's small gardens. The early Senecas depended on gardens to survive. Wild and cultivated fruits and vegetables were so important to the tribe's existence that they appear in many of their myths and ceremonies. Senecas continued to farm until their fertile bottomland was flooded by the Kensu Reservoir. Following the traditional cycles of their ancestors, Landon Sequoia and the other kids now help with planting and harvesting.
Corn's right there. A long time ago, they used to have big things of corn and beans and squash. That's the three sisters, Ganidayo and the three sisters. He was going to go back up to the sky world, and they grabbed onto his legs, and they told him not to go, or that they could go with him. But he was like, no, you have to stay down here to feed our people.
If you hadn't been in school, would you have ever had a garden?
I don't think so, because I was going to a public school, and I know hardly anything about our culture.
Many Senecas on the Allegheny Reservation believe their culture was nearly lost when the Kensu Dam was built. 15,000 of the 40,000 tribal acres were covered by the dam's reservoir. The Senecas and others strongly protested this project, but their arguments were turned down in the courts and the U.S. Congress. Tyler Heron is an elder and Seneca historian. He says that the Canandaigua Treaty of 1794 guaranteed that Seneca land would remain untouched by the United States government.
But the politics changed over 200 years. We weren't the threat. We weren't the political power anymore. And the threat, I guess, was the river itself to Pittsburgh, the flooding. And it was a threat to the economy.
Major floods along the lower Allegheny prompted the federal government to act. To make way for the dam, 600 Senecas were moved from their homes along the riverbanks. In 1964, contractors burned and bulldozed Seneca houses, trees, and public buildings. Churches and cemeteries were moved. Heron, who was 17 at the time, says life as he knew it has changed.
Even the ecology of the river itself has changed. My wife, for instance, used to make her extra money as a teenager by catching soft-shell crabs and selling them to the bait companies. But I don't think there's a soft-shell crab in the river anymore.
Aquatic plants were lost as well. The reservoir also inundated hardwoods used for carving ceremonial masks and many medicinal plants. Heron, whose grandchildren attend the Faith Keeper School, says these children are learning to identify the remaining plants. They're learning to speak the language and lead the ceremonies, and carry on for a community that suffered a great loss.
Our existence is dependent on us only, and we have to keep our identifiers. How do we kind of keep our identity? Well, language, it starts right here.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Ann Murray.
The earth is mother to the Senecas. They're trampling sacred ground. Change the mint green earth to black mud flats as honor hobbles down.
Finally today, it's another audio postcard in our series about the people who live, work, and play on Pittsburgh's three rivers, including sailors. Yep, you heard me right. Sailors. Most prefer big, open bodies of water, like the ocean or lakes, you know, to avoid the barge traffic. But one Pittsburgher has made it his personal mission to master the rivers on a sailboat.
Hi, my name is John Norton. I'm a resident of downtown Pittsburgh. I'm the guy who takes out a little sailboat, and you'll see me sailing around the point. The boat is a catamaran. I haven't given it a name. Maybe I should. It's a beautiful design. I've not seen anything, any other boat like it. Well, here, do you want to have a look? Well, I was born in Australia, and I grew up in Australia. Moved to Pittsburgh when I was about 30. Sailing is a very popular sport in Australia, so a lot of people just learn how to do it. It's just part of growing up. So the idea that when you see an interesting piece of water that, oh, this would be a great place to sail, that's just an automatic reaction. The question is, can you do it? River sailing is hard. It's a challenge. If you have a river current of 1 or 2 miles per hour, that's going to be a trial for a sailboat to beat. A sailboat's going to make a few miles an hour in a particular direction, but you can't always sail directly against the current. But that's what makes it immensely satisfying. You have to get all the pieces just right, and when you get all the pieces just right, you have an amazing experience. Get some of the pieces wrong, and it won't go well. Here's the dock. Just hang on a second. Have a look at the water there. Can you see little white caps forming? So one of the things you have to learn to do when you're a sailor is to read the water. So that's about 20 mile an hour winds. If I put the boat in, I could get out there and I could sail, but I would have a hell of a time. See, look at that. We're now, those winds are kicking out. They're gusting to 25, 30 miles an hour. That would be very unpleasant. In winds like that, I'd be in the water in no time. Well, the other boaters here don't really know what to do with me because Pittsburgh does not have a sailing culture. I'm the only one who sails regularly around the point. So sailboats are mysterious things. But there's a very, very different mindset between a sailor and a powerboater. With a powerboater, you get there, you open the throttle. It's the raw sense of power and speed. For me, it's the artistry. You know, I don't think there's any great achievement in sailing from here to the point. In a powerboat, it just means you put gas in the tank and turn the engine on and off you went. But for me to get there, that can be quite an achievement. I have to have the right winds, the right current, to know that I have them, I have to use them well. I succeed because I solve a continuous series of little problems. When I started sailing, I thought it would be a fairly simple matter to write a blog, explain what I was doing, say how much fun it was, and in no time at all, there'd be lots of other people doing it. It hasn't gone that way. I set a metric for success, and we're looking at the metric right here. I said success will be when there's a second sailboat sitting next to this one on the riverbank, and that was, what, 6 or 7 years ago, and I'm still the only one who has a sailboat here.
That was Three Rivers sailor John Norton. Our postcard was produced by the Allegheny Front's Lou Bluin for a series we call Our Three Rivers. To hear more from the people he's talked with, check out our website, AlleghenyFront.org/Our Three Rivers. Oh, and there's a link to John's sailing blog there, too. That's AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Julie Grant's our managing editor. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Carol Holsapple. Just because the show's over, that doesn't mean we have to lose touch. Let's chat on Facebook or Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. And join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.